This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have you been reducing the amount of water you're using? Connecticut Governor Dana Malloy has asked residents and businesses to voluntarily reduce water usage by 15% because the state is under a moderate to severe drought. Over the last three summers, the state has seen lower than normal precipitation. You can see the effect of the drought in some reservoirs around the state. Some residents point to the drought as a reason why the state should limit how much water a bottling facility in Bloomfield should be allowed to sell, especially if that water goes out of state. Today, where we live, we get an update on the issue. We'll follow up on a report from the Hartford Current on why the Hartford Regional Water Agency, the Metropolitan District, or MDC, will now release its water supply plan to a Bloomfield resident after it resisted making it public months earlier. And later, we spent a whole show last month talking about Hartford's money problems. Now the city may not be able to pay its MDC water bill. We'll find out what that means for other cities and towns in the region. State Senator Beth and MDC's Chief Executive Officer Scott Jellison will join us to talk about that issue. Do you live in a town served by the MDC? What kind of job do you think the Water and Sewer Agency is doing for your community? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WMPR.org. And as always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. First, I want to welcome back to the show Bloomfield resident Valerie Rossetti, who's also a member of Save Our Connecticut CT. Dr. Rossetti, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also here with us is Dan Clow, counsel at McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter. He also blogs at appealinglybrief.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lucy.
So I wanted to start off, Valerie, you live in Bloomfield. You became interested in the MDC after plans were announced to allow Niagara Bottling Company into your community with the intent to bottle the public water there. So when this happened, you became outspoken about this plan, but you were also seeking information from the MDC. Tell us what you were looking for.
Yeah, well, when this plan was announced, I was kind of shocked by initially what was announced to be 450,000 gallons of water a day. And then it became known that, no, it was actually 1.8 million gallons of water today. That's a lot of water. And I just wanted to know, what is the real water supply for our area? How are we determining it? Are there climate resiliency factors in there? How do we know what the triggers are for drought? What factors do they use to assess the health of the streams? Where else is the water going to be going? And I wanted to take a look at what a water supply plan was. Actually, the amount of water which was portrayed by the MDC as just kind of a drop in a bucket is equivalent to all the industrial use in the MDC area. And it's about one-eighth of all the excess water we have, if you believe the current figures, which are based in data that comes from the 1990s. And given what's going on right now with hotter temperatures, climate change, drought, and a state water planning process, I think the public needs to know what's going on with its water.
So you were looking for that document that had been public, the water supply plan. How did you go about requesting that?
Well, I visited the Department of Public Health where these plans are lodged, and I was told I couldn't see it. I needed an appointment, which I asked for, and then I was told it had to be redacted for public security reasons, anti-terrorism concerns. And a number of months went on as I kept being put off. And then I found that none of it was going to be released, not a single word, because the MDC had obtained a decision from Homeland Security that it was the complete document was protected, critically protected information. So we couldn't know anything about how much water, where it's coming from. I mean, obviously, we don't want to know where the controls are to the dams or where the water supply could most be affected, but information about how much water, where it's going, what are the projections for it in the future.
I mentioned Attorney Dan Clow is in studio with us. How unusual is this for a utility or this nonprofit water and sewer agency to ask for this federal declaration to make a public document not releasable?
It's incredibly unusual. In fact, the MDC, to our knowledge, is the only utility in Connecticut that has attempted to take advantage of this federal program. So and the timing, I mean, the fact is that this water supply plan that Val requested was created in 2008, and it sat at DPH until roughly April of this year when she made her request, and that's when the MDC tried to take advantage of this federal program. Very unusual.
The Hartford Courant's John Lender has reported on this, and we're going to send a link out on our Twitter and Facebooks of his report. So you filed a FOIA complaint when you found out about this declaration, Val.
I did, and part of it was for my own use. Part of it is as I was at the legislature battling to pass legislation which would regulate this water bottling industry in Connecticut, I began learning from environmental advocates that they'd been trying also to gain access to water data for planning purposes, and they've been increasingly frustrated. There's a state water planning process that's going on now, and it's kind of crazy. They're expected to look after the health of the streams as well as drinking water without knowing some of the very basic details about how much water and where it's going.
So this went, your request and your FOIA complaint went before the state's Freedom of Information Commission. There was a hearing last week. Let's hear some audio from what was determined at that meeting by Assistant Attorney General Carrie Colson. Here she is.
Last week, the department revisited with Homeland Security application of the federal act and regulations with respect to the 2008 water supply plan that they had on record. And they were advised that the unmarked plan, meaning that the plan had not been marked by Homeland Security as protected critical infrastructure information, could be disclosed to DAS for its safety risk determination.
So, Dan, explain what the determination was from the assistant AG. So, originally, Val Rossetti was told that this plan had a declaration from Homeland Security that could not be released. So now you're finding at this hearing that the state did an about-face.
A total about-face. And we're very pleased that it did, and we think that it reached the right decision in consultation with the Department of Homeland Security. Just to put it in context, what we're talking about, this federal law that we're talking about, was passed in 2002, shortly after the Patriot Act. And it was designed to allow, amongst other things, federal agencies and state agencies to mark certain kinds of information as critical infrastructure information and protect it against potential terrorist attacks. So the MDC attempted to have the water supply plan that it had created in 2008 classified that way. And initially, the Department of Public Health agreed with that. But as the FOI hearing approached last week, the Attorney General's office decided to speak to Homeland Security lawyers again, and that's where they concluded that no, in fact, this report could be released to the public.
So, Val Rossetti, you're finding this out 8 months after you originally put in that request just to get this public document. How do you feel about the decision last week?
Well, I'm really encouraged, and I'm really encouraged that other folks than myself will have access to it, specifically those involved with state water planning. Of course, we still have to wait to see when we get the information and how severely the information is redacted. And in general, I think there should be a process where the truly secure information is kept separate from what the public has a right to know to deal with its public trust water, so that every time a water supply plan is requested, it's not an issue again.
Meanwhile, the construction of the Niagara bottling facility has been ongoing. Where does that stand?
Well, they're not friends with me, but I understand it's nearing completion. They had an initial plan to open up 1 to 2 bottling lines, and we're really hoping that that's all they're allowed to do. You know, this bottling plant opened up with a lot of lack of transparency and secrecy. It had no permitting process because the MDC had what's called a registration to use its water. Nobody had to decide, is this the highest, best use of our public trust water? There's no limitation on their drawing water, extracting it from the state during a drought, and they're utilizing a loophole in which normally water that's water that's piped across watersheds requires a permit. It requires DEEP to look at whether that's a wise environmental use. This is a gnawing loophole in which they can take trucks and truck water out of the state even without any kind of regulation. So I'm hoping that we limit what's going on to there are one or two bottling lines. And I'm also hoping that there's a way for the state to say, look, when we're in a time of drought, we should not be shipping single-serve water bottles to Massachusetts or Rhode Island. Right now, there is no protection for that kind of thing in our drought plan. There's no way to prioritize residential use. And the water bottling industry is different from other industries. It's extracting a natural resource and shipping it out of our state.
I want to turn back to Attorney Dan Clough before we hear from some officials from the MDC. So now the water supply plan from 2008, it'll go through a process where sensitive information will be redacted. How soon will this plan be made public?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. So under the State Freedom of Information Act, the water supply plan is given to the Department of Administrative Services, which is charged with reviewing it line by line. Keep in mind that we're talking about an 800-ish page multi-binder report. And it does that. It does it in consultation with MDC, so MDC will have input. But your guess is as good as mine as to how long it will take. We certainly have encouraged the commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services, Melody Curry, to place a priority on this, particularly given that Val originally asked for this information back in March. But the truthful answer to your question is we do not know how long it will take.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're looking, getting an update on the Niagara Bottling Facility being built in Bloomfield and as it relates to the MDC, the Metropolitan District, and the eight member towns that are part of that Hartford Regional Sewer and Water Agency. Joining us now by phone is Scott Jellison. He's Chief Executive Officer of the MDC, as well as Bart Halloran, who's the District Counsel for the agency. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
So, Scott, if I could begin with you, could we find out why the MDC sought to block the release of this water document way back in March?
I'm going to give you a little bit of a history of what we're dealing with here at the MDC and with other water utilities across the country. Then I'm going to let Bart handle that. But some of this was made reference in the earlier discussion. 2001, after 9/11, EPA mandated, due to anti-terrorism, that all utilities were required to develop a vulnerability assessment and enacted the FOI exemption for water supply plans. And so that's where the water supply plans have been protected to date under the FOI process. The reason, well, let's put it this way. In 2016, the challenge that the DPH has had is the process isn't, even after this FOI declaration, the process hasn't changed. The challenge that DPH has always had with this process is that when they get a request from FOI to ask about a water supply plan, they have to redact it. And when they redact it, they traditionally get a number of complaints from the public to say that they've redacted too much. And so that's why DPH initiated in February of 2016 our recommendations on changing the FOI request. And the changes were really concerning to us because it was really about changing who decides and make it easier for DPH because of their staffing concerns. So as a water utility, we're very concerned about DPH is really the only qualified agency of the state who can determine what is and should be redacted. As most of us know or may know, that 2015 there was a dam in Ryburg, New York that was hacked, and they took over control of some of their important controls for their dam. And Senator Charles Schumer from New York indicated, you know, this is a wake-up call to the nation for our critical infrastructure. That's just one example. We have had reports of another water utility that the hackers actually came in and changed the levels of chemicals in the water system. And you can imagine the impacts not only to the quality of the water, but we also utilize the chemistry of the water to allow us to check to determine if there are anything occurring out in the distribution. So this is a real issue. We have had The MDC and other utilities in Connecticut have had issues. We can't really talk about them, but there were documented incidents that occurred at Quabbin Reservoir right after the Boston bombing. These are real issues. And what I'd like to just make the point is that even after this FOI request and determination, the process hasn't changed. DPH will still need to redact what they believe is sensitive. And if Bart, if you could just add to that.
Sure. Bart Halloran speaking. First of all, let me just say the Freedom of Information request went to the Department of Public Health, not to us. So the coincidence of timing is just that. It's a coincidence.
Well, so let's just update our listeners. So Val Rossetti, who's a Bloomfield resident, requested this information late February, early March. And then just 2 days later, this request by MDC to look for this Homeland Security Declaration. You said it's just a coincidence?
It is, because she didn't file the request with us. She filed it with Department of Public Health, and the first we found out about her request was probably in August of this year at one of the water utility meetings. So, and I think that she would confirm that she didn't send it to us. So the reason that we went forward with this Homeland Security designation was not simply the water plan. MDC is also does the sewers in the region also. And so there's a lot of MDC, which is, in fact, critical infrastructure. The opportunity to have Homeland Security review our critical infrastructure was made known to us by DEMAS, the State Agency for Security. And so we asked for a review of both our sewer and our water by Homeland Security. While that review is pending, you cannot release the information. And ultimately, they reviewed the plans and found it to be critical infrastructure. Now, having said that, a lot of the information which we're discussing here is on our website. It is not, we have made no attempt to protect, for instance, what the safe yield is or anything else. What we have sought to protect is sources and how you would get access to the system. And, you know, people can criticize us for that, but one of the other water companies right in our area just over the last month had somebody break in and dump 40 million gallons of water out of their reservoir at a time when a drought's going on. So we take these responsibilities extremely seriously. Obviously, the public has a right to know as to certain parts of the information, but frankly, we've already made that public.
So, Bart, if I could ask you, so now that the assistant AG made that determination last week at the FOIA hearing, I mean, how will you be working with the Department of Administrative Services, I believe, to redact what you say could be sensitive information in that document before it becomes public?
Well, what usually has happened in the past is that the state of Connecticut makes those determinations without our input, frankly. But we would be happy to provide our input as to what the truly necessarily protected parts of the plan are and work it out with everybody. But as to the basic information as to how much water there is, that's something that, as I say, is on our website right now. You can just go look it up.
I want to have Val Rossetti respond.
Well, I think there are questions about how much water there really is. I was interested because some of these projections are based on 1990s data. I was very interested to see if there are any projections related to climate change going on. We've had 3 years now in which precipitation has been less than average. The rain is coming in more bursts. The ground is drying out so it can't absorb as much water. I don't know whether any of those projections include climate change, for example. I don't know how the hydrology is being measured. And I think those are really apt projections that need to be looked at. We've been going to my group, Save Our Water Connecticut, has been attending water utility and state water planning meetings. And one thing we've heard is that, for example, the MDC and other utilities are worried about releasing water to the streams in the state, because that would compromise the amount of drinking water we have. If there's so much water that we can give it to a California corporation to ship out of state, I would much rather see it go to a stream and keep the aquatic environment healthy in Connecticut.
I want to take a quick call. Mark's been holding from Bloomfield. Mark, you're on the show.
Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to respond to that also. You know, I just recently drove the Connecticut reservoir system and the length of the Farmington River up to Massachusetts, and I was shocked to see the low levels that I witnessed. It was quite scary to me, knowing that that the levels are what I could visually see them to be, where a bridge is visible that was underwater before in a reservoir where they closed an area to make, I think that was Colebrook. And so my question is, how can you justify high volume discounts to an out-of-state company for water when you can't consider releasing water into our water system, into the Farmington River? Maybe you're not making the money, and maybe that's what it's driving the whole thing, is all about where money's coming from. I'm sure you'll get to that, but that's my question.
All right, Mark, thank you for your question. I'll pose that to Scott Jellison. He's the CEO of the MDC. Obviously, residents are concerned about the drought conditions and how this Niagara bottling facility is going forward. Scott.
Yes, thank you. And as the gentleman mentioned, Mark, I believe, regarding Colebrook Reservoir and the Goodwin Reservoir, they're joint at the hip up in Colebrook. One of the reservoirs, Colebrook, has 30 billion gallons of water, and the other reservoir, smaller reservoir, has 3 billion gallons. That reservoir system is an emergency source of water for exactly that, for purposes of drought. The challenge that we have had is those two reservoir systems are intended to release water, and it releases at a minimum of 32 million gallons a day, and it's for purposes of stream flow for aquatic life. And so the challenge that we've had is, without rain since June, we have actually depleted all of that water in Colebrook, and now we are in the process of depleting the water in Goodwin. So as you can imagine, the MDC is, we have just broken 77% capacity in our drinking water reservoirs. We're down to 76.6%. And we would expect, given the conditions that we're seeing, we could possibly go the entire winter without any rain or snow. And we will be in May, we will be in the second drought trigger, which is 53%. Now, if you look at stream flow regs and you look at how those minimum stream flows have depleted those two reservoir systems, Colebrook and Goodwin, if we were to release a minimum of 32 million gallons from those drinking water reservoirs, we would be in the same circumstance. We would be in the 40 to 50% range of capacity right now. So the challenge that we have is making everyone, and it's a difficult conversation, but making everyone understand that Niagara is 1 million gallons a day or 1.8 million gallons a day. In order to sustain aquatic life, we are releasing 32 million gallons a day. The MDC only has about 14 million gallons a day of water to sell in excess. So in order for us to use our excess water, roughly 14 million gallons, you can't sustain aquatic life. The DEEP has already told us, we've had a couple of meetings with DEEP Fisheries Group, and they have told us in order to sustain the spawning cycle for they're trying to establish a wild brown trout, a native brown trout. Right now it's an artificial trout that they're trying to sustain in the West Branch of the Farmington River. They have told us that they need about 80 million gallons a day during the third week of October to sustain spawning. So the challenge is, we don't have that much water, and no one does, especially this time of year and especially during this drought. So all I would say is that Niagara is 1.8 million gallons a day. My understanding is that they're going to have the first bottling line up and running in December. The second bottling line will be up and running
in February. We can more than handle Niagara. We're also going to be supporting during this drought. As you, most of you may have known, New Britain is actually at 35% capacity in their reservoirs. Their reservoirs look like Colebrook, believe it or not.
So, Scott, I'm sorry. We're going to have to take a quick break. We're going to ask that you stay on the line. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. But I do want to thank Val Rossetti, a Bloomfield resident, and Attorney Dan Clough for joining us to talk about this water supply plan. When we come back, we're going to have State Senator Beth Bai join us as we continue the conversation with MDC officials. We're looking to how other towns are going to have to foot the bill for Hartford, most likely. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking water today. Our focus is on the Hartford Region's Water and Sewer Agency, the Metropolitan District, or MDC, which serves eight towns, including the capital city. On the phone with us is Scott Jellison. He's MDC's chief executive officer. And joining us now in studio is State Senator Beth Bai, who represents Bloomfield and West Hartford, two of the towns in the MDC. Welcome back to the show, Senator.
Yes, and Farmington, which is not represented but pays part of MDC's bill, and Burlington as well. So happy to be here.
So obviously, the MDC has been in the news a lot because of this Niagara bottling facility, which we hear is soon to be completed. But another issue has popped up, and that is because of Hartford's continuing budget problems, member towns of the MDC will now have to possibly foot the bill. Can you talk about reaction from your constituents?
Yeah, I really can because I've been out on the campaign trail. Derek Slapp and I were together one day campaigning, and it was the top issue on people's minds, saying, what? How are we supposed to pick up $4 million in additional bills as a community? And that was in West Hartford, and residents of Bloomfield and Farmington are also concerned. But basically what it boiled down to for me, because I was involved with the Niagara fight, trying to help great advocates who were trying to get their voices heard, is that people don't know where to go when it comes to MDC. And I learned it was a municipality, but I know nobody votes on a town council or representatives. And so as my constituents with the Niagara issue and on this issue of paying a higher share of the regional cost went to complain, they didn't know where to go. And then as the more they tried to advocate, the more frustrated they became. So when the second piece came up during the campaign, Derek Slapp and I were like, we've got to do something. We've got to look at this governance structure and make it good governance, because you could hear from Scott Jellison. He said, the control of water is critical for public safety. It's a critical infrastructure. It's a public resource. Yet the public doesn't feel any control over what's happening with it, at least the ones who've come to me. Now, if they felt like things were working and in place, they wouldn't come to the legislature. You know, MDC would have a drought protection plan that the residents would feel comfortable with because they'd had input over it and felt some nexus of control, but really people feel like things are out of control and they don't know how to get their voices heard.
We just have 5 minutes left in the conversation. I wanted to turn back to the CEO of MDC, Scott Jellison. You just heard from Senator Bai. A lot of citizens are frustrated. What's your take?
Yes. Hi, Senator. How are you?
Great.
I just would like to say is that I like Bart to weigh in on this, but the challenge that the MDC has is that we're obviously on a calendar year budget. So we start preparing our budgets in August, and we're trying to get the budget finalized through a public process in late October. And as everyone knows, it's no secret the city of Hartford is in trouble financially. They have made a number of statements publicly. In a September meeting, the chief financial officer from Hartford came to one of our scheduled meetings with our town finance and elected officials, and was asked the question by the city of West Hartford, are you going to be able to make your payments to the MDC? And the answer was, we don't know. We have cash flow issues in June of 17. So the challenge that we have is that we're the first ones out of the gate developing a budget. You know, the town, the states, they're starting their budget process in April. So we have Hartford is $11 million of a $70 million sewer budget, and we, you know, I can't in good conscience develop a budget with an assumption that, that Hartford's going to pay, given the legal ramifications, and I'll let Bart get into this, the legal ramifications of if Hartford doesn't pay.
I'm sorry, Scott. We just don't have time. I wanted just to ask you, though, quickly. Obviously, Hartford could go bankrupt. Some towns are balking at having to foot the bill. Niagara Bottling is a source of revenue. If there is a system in place to control how much water is bottled, could this be another way for the MDC to make money, open it up to other companies, such as Niagara?
I apologize. I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
If there's an issue with revenue, and if Hartford can't pay the bill, if Niagara Bottling is a way to make money, could MDC open this up to other companies to come in and sell water?
This is Bart Halloran speaking. There are two different things. The problem right now is with the sewer side, which is the towns each pay what's called ad valorem, the 8-member towns, for the sewer services. So if Hartford can't pay under the MDC charter, really the only recourse the MDC has is to spread the pain to the other municipalities. The water side is kept separate from that. And although it would affect water rates, selling more water, it would not affect this problem on the sewers.
And I'll let State Senator By weigh in. So what happens if the towns have to foot the bill?
Well, I can tell you the towns are balking already. Their residents are paying higher water bills because of these sewer tax where they're paying. Some of them call my office and say, my bill has doubled. So now their water bill's doubled. And now MDC is saying, you know what? And we're going to raise your property taxes too because your town's going to pick up $4 million. It's just unacceptable to the residents of those communities.
And Val Rossetti is here.
I have a great idea. How about having Niagara Bottling pay the actual cost of the water and pay the same amount that the residents
do? And for the sewers. Let them pay for the sewer costs.
They are receiving a huge discount on their clean water project charge once they use 500,000 gallons a day. No one else is. If they want to come, if a California corporation wants to come and profit off our water infrastructure, let them pay their fair share. We do not want to encourage water overuse by massive discounts for super users.
And Scott Jellison from the MDC, I'll let you have the last word. We have 1 minute.
Yeah, we understand that concern. We're in our budget process as we speak. Our rates are set yearly. We have a Board of Finance meeting on Wednesday night this week. So we understand that concern, and we will address it. This year.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, MDC Chief Executive Officer Scott Jellison. Also, their chief counsel was on the line, Bart Halloran. Beth Bye, we're going to hear about this in January at the session begins.
And we're going to put in drought protections.
All right, and I want to thank Val Rossetti. We just ran out of time, but we're glad that we were able to have part of this discussion. We're going to return soon. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, poll stations across the country are gearing up for crowds, and the world watches to see who's voted in and who's voted out. On the next Where We Live, Election Day, we'll talk local and regional politics, and then we'll chat with our northern neighbors to see how one Canadian community is profiting from our turbulent election season. Join the conversation on Tuesday. Tomorrow will be the culmination of one of the most contentious and strange presidential campaigns in our history. The two major party candidates have highlighted how divided a nation we've become, but no matter the turnout, we still need to live and work with people who have different political beliefs. With that in mind, we're revisiting an earlier conversation on the importance of civility with author Keith J. Bybee. He's professor of law and political science at Syracuse University, author of the book How Civility Works. Keith, welcome to Where We Live.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing that this presidential race, it's been referred to as one of the most uncivil political contests in the U.S., in U.S. history. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with it, but I think it's important to recognize that you can think about the current election, and oftentimes you can think about bursts of incivility in at least two ways. One way to look at this, and particularly the actions of Donald Trump, but to some extent Hillary Clinton as well, are not so much acts of incivility that are attempting to destroy some consensus view of the respect we owe one another, but more as acts of provocation designed to attract attention. Someone who engages in a kind of strategic rudeness counts on agreement and counts on the existence of some consensus over what constitutes good manners. They then violate that code of conduct and use the outrage that's generated as a result to attract attention to a particular issue or to the person themselves. And sometimes we see that in politics. It's not an assault on civility so much as a use of the existence of consensus beliefs about appropriate behavior. But other times, and I think we're seeing some of this campaign, it's an effort to displace, if not tear down, consensus understandings of what constitutes appropriate behavior and replace them with a recalibrated standard of respect. And it's the latter standard that I think we might be seeing now, and frankly, we've seen at many periods throughout American history.
Let's talk about that. In your book, or I think I saw an article that you wrote talking about how civility has been challenged. Let's look at the civil rights movement, for instance.
That's a great example, because we often think of the civil rights movement as yielding, as it certainly did, important legislative achievements, leading to important statutes like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But part of the work and part of the challenge of the civil rights movement was to confront and reverse a well-established form of racial etiquette that surrounded and sustained Jim Crow segregation. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote about this racial etiquette in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Now, there were ways of behaving that enacted a racial hierarchy. In order to be a polite or courteous individual, you participated in a kind of social life that put whites on top and African Americans on the bottom. So part of the work of the civil rights movement was to change civility, to make it more inclusive, make it more egalitarian. And there have been other episodes like this throughout American history. And I think the lesson it teaches is that civility is not outside of our politics. It's not a standard that we can appeal to just restrain and pacify our disputes. Instead, it's something that's often the subject of political conflict itself, something we determine through our disputes. So it might seem odd to compare what's happening in this contentious presidential campaign to the historic civil rights movement in the 20th century, but in the sense that both of them are involved in a politics of civility, trying to determine what will count as our standard of appropriate behavior, there's really a connection between the two.
Let's talk more about, you mentioned provocation earlier. In your book, you mentioned, again, strategic incivility. So the idea that Donald Trump is using, you know, pushing the boundaries, saying things that other people, you know, wouldn't want to say in public, that that's a way to appeal to certain supporters.
It can be. You know, you can think of this strategic incivility as a kind of jujitsu that provokes people, but not for the sake of just making them angry, but for the sake of redirecting their attention towards a new set of questions. And Donald Trump, before he ran for president, is a well-known self-promoter and showman, and he's really quite adept at winning the news cycle. I think we've seen that again and again over this very long presidential election season. He's really a master at gaining attention. I think what's interesting and what moves us beyond maybe talk of strategic incivility in the case of the Trump campaign is that many of his followers like him probably principally because he tells it like it is, because he says what other politicians won't say. And I don't think that they like that just simply because it generates outrage. I think at least among some of his followers, a large plurality of the electorate, they're interested in recalibrating our understanding of civility, of changing this baseline understanding of respect that we owe one another in public life. And if that's the case, then this debate over what's acceptable to say is going to continue well after the November election is done, regardless of who wins.
I'm speaking with Keith J. Bybee. He's professor of law and political science at Syracuse University. He's author of the new book, How Civility Works. You know, Keith, when did you decide to write this book? Were you observing the campaign season and you thought now's a good time to talk about civility?
I wish that were the case, that I had a finger in the wind and saw coming a historic campaign that would raise in a bold way these deep questions about appropriate behavior. But in fact, I've been thinking about manners for some time, and I've used them in previous scholarship of mine as an analytical lens for trying to understand how Americans think about courts and judges. Many Americans see judges as impartial arbiters, but same large number of Americans also worry that judges are motivated by political factors. So wondering how it could be that people could at once be skeptical of judges and believe that maybe judges are not quite saying what they mean when they chalk up their decisions to principles of law, but nonetheless accept judges even if they're skeptical, led me to a rich historic literature on politeness, courtesy, and civility, where we accept civility, we think it's important, but we often doubt its authenticity. Mm. We worry that people are just being polite, that they don't actually like us, that they're just behaving appropriately. Yet nonetheless, we think civility is important. So I came to it for these kind of more scholarly reasons, but once I started to think more squarely about civility, apart from the question of public perceptions of the judiciary, I realized that I was coming to it at a time when much of the country was going to be confronted front and center with this question of appropriate behavior.
You mentioned the importance of people seeing someone acting genuine. So again, Trump saying what he thinks, and that's something that people see as an advantage if they support him. But on the flip side, if you look at Hillary, you know, she can be considered the more civil candidate, but that doesn't mean people like her or think that she's being genuine because she's a politician. You know, you can't believe everything she says.
No, you know, and I think that's the kind of the doubleness of civility is that as we say, civility, the definition of it, is the baseline of mutual respect. And we owe one another in public life. It's appropriate behavior. It's how we think people ought to behave. But when one is behaving civilly, there's no guarantee that you actually mean it. Someone could be polite to you because they're actually a gracious person, genuinely a gracious person. Or they could be an unrepentant rogue and still be unfailingly polite. There's no requirement that your intentions match up with your behavior when it comes to civility. So there's constantly suspicion that's there whether somebody really means it. And that suspicion really does seem to attend to many of Hillary Clinton's actions. She is, of the two candidates, much more conventionally civil. But I think there's this longstanding concern whether her intentions match her behaviors. You know, and as an illustration of this, how big the gap can be between intentions and behavior, you know, we see in this switching from Clinton to Trump, the video that was released of conversation that Donald Trump had with Billy Bush on the bus, and you see them talking one way on the bus and then instantly switching gears and behaving quite differently once they're off the bus. Now, that's a pretty egregious example of how great the distance can be between intentions and behavior. But it's true for all of us when we are engaged in cordial behavior. Do we really mean it? It's hard to know many times. Because civility is as civility does. It's not a matter of intentions. And so the suspicion, whether we're really good people or whether we're just acting like good and decent people, is one that is baked into the activity of civil behavior.
And then beyond behavior, I mean, don't we need civility to encourage cooperation, that we get along, that we learn to have disagreements, but it doesn't mean that we're going to ridicule or degrade someone because of their, you know, their opinions?
Well, that's exactly right. That's the great promise of civility. You know, if you think it's possible to make everybody agree, make sure that we all have the same views and all have the same values, then you wouldn't need civility. We could just all be real friends. That's one view, but in a society like ours, it's very large, incredibly diverse, incredibly dynamic. You have lots of people with conflicting interests, conflicting beliefs, and yet we still have to work with one another. We still live together in society. And civility provides a kind of lingua franca, a mechanism by which we can all get along, even if we deeply disagree, even if we don't particularly like one another. Civility gives us a mechanism of displaying signs of respect for others, and in turn, communicating that we ourselves should be shown similar signs of respect. So it's a important social lubricant, and not just lubricant, it's also just grease and it's glue. It allows us, kind of smooths out the friction between us, but it holds us together and allows us to gain cooperative, collectively beneficial activity.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Keith J. Bybee. He's professor of law and political science at Syracuse, author of the new book, How Civility Works. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Keith, you mentioned that video that broke with Donald Trump and this TV host on a bus with very vulgar language. Why was that the breaking point? Again, when we look back at the campaign season, you write about this too. I mean, Hillary Clinton has brought this up. Trump has insulted many people from many backgrounds. You know, Mexican immigrants are rapists. John McCain's not a hero because he was a POW. A journalist has a disability. He mocks them. Why was that video? Why did that appear to be the breaking point for many Americans?
I think there are a couple of reasons, and all of which have some truth to it. I think one of the reasons is, just as you said, there have been many violations of appropriate electioneering etiquette. And at some point, it's just a bridge too far. So there's that. I think there's also just the fact that you can look at the calendar. We're now in October. Many public officials who are running for re-election have a much clearer sense of where they stand in their own race with the election, just less than a month away. And so they're able to make, decisions that before they were waiting to see what polls looked like. But I think the reason for our purposes that's most important is that tape really revealed this gap that I was referring to earlier between the outward signs, conventional civil behavior, and inward intentions, true beliefs. I mean, one of the bases on which Donald Trump has been able to win so much support is his reputation as a straight shooter, a truth teller, a person who tells it like it is. And what we see in that tape is that he's not telling it like it is. He gets off the bus and behaves in a way that's very different than the kind of banter, the vulgar banter that he was engaging in with that television host. And so I think part of it is that's a damaging piece of information to have in the case of somebody who is won support on the basis of their brutal honesty. You see them engaging in artificial behavior. And so it's added to those other reasons identified. It's just the straw that broke the camel's back, plus we're getting close enough to the election that self-interested political actors have a much clearer sense of which way the wind is blowing.
Keith J. Bybee is professor of law and political science at Syracuse University, author of the new book, How Civility Works. Thanks for talking with us today, Keith.
Thanks for having me on.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WNPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Check out wmpr.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.